ended, but his arm was still around her. She was doe-eyed with lust now, and soft-spoken.
"I think you should come and talk to him seriously. He keeps talking about that bloody detective."
"What?" said Jimmy, though Strike could tell he'd heard.
"Strike, that bastard soldier with the one leg. Billy's fixated on him. Thinks he's going to rescue him."
The end point of the march came into sight at last. Bow Quarter in Fairfield Road, where the square brick tower of an old match factory, proposed site of some of the planned missiles, punctured the skyline.
"Rescue him?" repeated Jimmy scornfully. "Fuck's sake. It's not like he's been fucking tortured."
The marchers were breaking ranks now, dissolving back into a formless crowd that milled around a dark green pond in front of the proposed missile site. Strike would have given much to sit down on a bench or lean up against a tree, as many of the protesters were doing, so as to take the weight off his stump. Both the end, where skin that was never meant to bear his weight was irritated and inflamed, and the tendons in his knee were begging for ice and rest. Instead, he limped on after Jimmy and Flick as they walked around the edge of the crowd, away from their core colleagues.
"He wanted to see you, and I told him you were busy," he heard Flick say. "And he cried. It was horrible, Jimmy."
Pretending to be watching the young black man with a microphone, who was ascending a stage at the front of the crowd, Strike edged closer to Jimmy and Flick.
"I'll look after Billy when I get the money," Jimmy was telling Flick. He seemed guilty and conflicted now. "Obviously I'll look after him. And you. I won't forget what you've done."
She liked hearing that. Out of the corner of his eye, Strike saw her grubby face flush with excitement. Jimmy took a pack of tobacco and some Rizzlers from his jeans pocket and began to roll himself another cigarette.
"Still talking about that fucking detective, is he?"
"Yeah."
Jimmy lit up and smoked in silence for a while, his eyes roving abstractedly over the crowd.
"Tell you what," he said suddenly. "I'll go see him now, calm him down a bit. We just need him to stay put a bit longer. Come in?"
He held out his hand and Flick took it, smiling. They walked away. Strike let them get a short head start, then stripped off the mask and the old grey hoodie, replaced the former with the sunglasses he had pocketed for this eventuality, and set off after them, dumping the mask and hoodie on top of their banners. The pace Jimmy now set was completely different to the leisurely march. Every few strides Flick had to jog to keep up, and Strike was soon gritting his teeth as the nerve endings at the inflamed skin at the end of his stump rubbed against the prosthesis, his overworked thigh muscles groaning in protest. He was perspiring hard, his gait becoming more and more unnatural. Passers-by were starting to stare. He could feel their curiosity and pity as he dragged his prosthetic leg along. He knew he should have been doing his bloody physio exercises, that he ought to have kept to the no-chips rule, that in an ideal world he'd have taken the day off today and rested up, the prosthesis off, an ice pack on his stump. On he limped, refusing to listen to the body pleading with him to stop, the distance between himself, Jimmy, and Flick growing ever wider, the compensating movement of his upper body and arms becoming grotesque. He could only pray that neither Jimmy nor Flick would turn and look behind them, because there was no way Strike could remain incognito if they saw him hobbling along like this. They were already disappearing into the neat little brick box that was Bow Station, while Strike was panting and swearing on the opposite side of the road. As he stepped off the curb, an excruciating pain shot through the back of his right thigh, as though a knife had sliced through the muscle. The leg buckled and he fell, his outstretched hands skidding along asphalt, hitting hip, shoulder, and head on the open road. Somewhere in the vicinity, a woman yelped in shock. Onlookers would think he was drunk. It had happened before when he had fallen. Humiliated, furious, groaning in agony, Strike crawled back onto the pavement, dragging his right leg out of the way of oncoming traffic. A young woman approached nervously,
to see whether he needed help. He barked at her, then felt guilty.
"Sorry,"
he croaked, but she was gone, hurrying away with two friends. He dragged himself to the railings bordering the pavement and sat there, back against metal, sweating and bleeding. He doubted whether he would be able to stand again without assistance. Running his hands over the back of his stump, he felt an egg-shaped swelling and, with a groan, guessed that he had torn a hamstring. The pain was so sharp that it was making him feel sick. He tucked his mobile out of his pocket. The screen was cracked where he had fallen on it.
"Fuck it all,"
he muttered, closing his eyes and leaning his head back against the cold metal. He sat motionless for several minutes, dismissed as a tramp or a drunk by the people navigating around him, while he silently assessed his limited options. At last, with a sense of being utterly cornered, he opened his eyes, wiped his face with his forearm, and punched in Lorelei's number. Chapter 23. Ailing and languishing in the gloom of such a marriage. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. In retrospect, Robin knew that her anniversary weekend had been doomed before it had even begun, down in the House of Commons crypt, where she had turned down Strike's request to tail Jimmy. Trying to throw off her sense of guilt, she had confided Strike's request to Matthew when he picked her up after work. Already tense due to the demands of navigating the Friday night traffic in the Land Rover, which he disliked, Matthew went on the offensive, demanding to know why she felt bad after all the slave labor Strike had had out of her over the past 2 years, and proceeding to badmouth Strike so viciously that Robin had felt compelled to defend him. They were still arguing about her job an hour later, when Matthew noticed that there was neither wedding nor engagement ring on Robin's gesticulating left hand. She never wore these when playing the unmarried Venetia Hall, and had entirely forgotten that she would not be able to retrieve them from Albury Street before leaving for the hotel. "It's our bloody anniversary, and you can't even remember to put your rings back on," Matthew had shouted. They drew up outside the soft golden brick hotel an hour and a half later. A beaming man in uniform opened the door for Robin. Her "thank you" was almost inaudible due to the hard, angry lump in her throat. They barely spoke over their Michelin-starred dinner. Robin, who might as well have been eating polystyrene and dust, looked around at the surrounding tables. She and Matthew were by far the youngest couple there, and she wondered whether any of these husbands and wives had been through this kind of trough in their marriages and survived it. They slept back to back that night. Robin woke on Saturday in the awareness that every moment in the hotel, every step through the beautifully cultivated grounds, with the lavender walk, the Japanese garden, the orchard and organic vegetable beds, was costing them a small fortune. Perhaps Matthew was thinking the same, because he became conciliatory over breakfast. Nevertheless, their conversation felt perilous, straying regularly into dangerous territory from which they retreated precipitately. A tension headache began pounding behind Robin's temple, but she did not want to ask hotel staff for painkillers, because any sign of dissatisfaction might lead to another argument. Robin wondered what it would be like to have a wedding day and honeymoon about which it was safe to reminisce. They eventually settled on talking about Matthew's job as they strolled the grounds. There was to be a charity cricket match between his firm and another the following Saturday. Matthew, who was as good at cricket as he had been at rugby, was greatly looking forward to the game. Robin listened to his boasts about his own prowess and jokes about Tom's inadequate bowling, laughed at the appropriate moments and made sounds of agreement, and all the time a chilled and miserable part of her was wondering what was happening right now in Bow. Whether Strike had gone on the march, whether he was getting anything useful on Jimmy, and wondering how she, Robin, had ended up with a pompous, self-involved man beside her, who reminded her of a handsome boy she had once loved. For the first time ever, Robin had sex with Matthew that night, purely because she could not face the row that would ensue if she refused. It was their anniversary, so they had to have sex, like a notary's stamp on the weekend, and about as pleasurable. Tears stung her eyes as Matthew climaxed, and that cold, unhappy self buried deep in her compliant body wondered why he could not feel her unhappiness, even though she was trying so hard to dissemble, and how he could possibly imagine that the marriage was a success. She put her arm over her wet eyes in the darkness after he had rolled off her and said all the things she was supposed to say. For the first time, when she said, "I love you too," she knew beyond doubt that she was lying. Very carefully, once Matthew was asleep, Robin reached out in the darkness for the phone that lay on her bedside table and checked her texts. There was nothing from Strike. She googled pictures of the march in Bow and thought she recognized in the middle of the crowd a tall man with familiar curly hair who was wearing a Guy Fawkes mask. Robin turned her mobile face down on the bedside table to shut out its light and closed her eyes. Chapter 24. Her ungovernable, wild fits of passion, which she expected me to reciprocate. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Strike returned to his two attic rooms in Denmark Street 6 days later, early on Friday morning. Leaning on crutches, his prosthesis in a holdall over his shoulder and his right trouser leg pinned up, his expression tended to repel the sidelong glances of sympathy that passers-by gave him as he swung along the short street to number 24. He hadn't seen a doctor. Lorelei had called her local practice once she and a lavishly tipped cabbie had succeeded in supporting Strike upstairs to her flat, but the GP had asked Strike to come into his surgery for an examination. "What do you want me to do, hop there? It's my hamstring, I can feel it," he had snapped down the phone. "I know the drill. Rest, ice, all that bollocks. I've done it before." He had been forced to break his no consecutive overnights at a woman's rule, spending 4 full days and 5 nights at Lorelei's. He now regretted it, but what choice had he had? He had been caught, as Chisel would have put it, a fronte praecipitium a tergo lupi. He and Lorelei had been supposed to have dinner on Saturday night. Having chosen to tell her the truth rather than make an excuse not to meet, he had been forced to let her help. Now he wished that he had phoned his old friends Nick and Ilse, or even Shanker, but it was too late. The damage was done. The knowledge that he was being unfair and ungrateful was hardly calculated to improve Strike's mood as he dragged himself and his holdall up the stairs. In spite of the fact that parts of the sojourn at Lorelei's flat had been thoroughly enjoyable, all had been ruined by what happened the previous evening, and it was entirely his own fault. He had let it happen, the thing that he had tried to guard against ever since leaving Charlotte. Let it happen because he dropped his guard and accepted mugs of tea, home-cooked meals, and gentle affection. Until finally, last night in the darkness, she had whispered onto his bare chest, "I love you." Grimacing again with the effort of balancing on his crutches as he unlocked his front door, Strike almost fell into his flat. Slamming the door behind him, he dropped the holdall, crossed to the small chair at the formica table in his kitchen come living room, fell into it and cast his crutches aside. It was a relief to be home and alone, however difficult it was to manage with his leg in this state. He ought to have returned sooner, of course, but being in no condition to tail anyone and in considerable discomfort, it had been easier to remain in a comfortable armchair, his stump resting on a large square poof, texting Robin and Barclay instructions while Lorelei fetched him food and drink. Strike lit a cigarette and thought back over all the women there had been since he'd left Charlotte. First, Kiara Parker, a gorgeous one-night stand, with no regrets on either side. A few weeks after he had hit the press for solving the Landry case, Kiara had called him. He had become elevated in the model's mind from casual shag to possible boyfriend material by his newsworthiness, but he had turned down further meetings with her. Girlfriends who wanted to be photographed with him were no good to him in his line of work. Next had come Nina, who had worked for a publisher and whom he had used to get information on a case. He had liked her, but insufficiently, as he looked back on it, to treat her with common consideration. He had hurt Nina's feelings. He wasn't proud of it, but it hardly kept him up at nights. Ellen had been different. Beautiful and, best of all, convenient, which was why he'd hung around. She had been in the process of divorcing a wealthy man, and her need for discretion and compartmentalization had been at least as great as his own. They had managed a few months together before he'd spilled wine all over her and walked out of the restaurant where they were having dinner. He had called her afterwards to apologize, and she had dumped him before he finished the sentence. Given that he had left her humiliated in Le Gavroche with a hefty dry-cleaning bill, he felt that it would have been in poor taste to respond with, "That's what I was going to say next." After Ellen, there had been Coco, on whom he preferred not to dwell. And now there was Lorelei. He liked her better than any of the others, which was why he was sorry that it had been she who said, "I love you." Strike had made a vow to himself 2 years previously, and he made very few vows, because he trusted himself to keep them. Having never said, "I love you," to any woman but Charlotte, he would not say it to another unless he knew, beyond reasonable doubt, that he wanted to stay with that woman and make a life with her. It would make a mockery of what he'd been through with Charlotte if he said it under circumstances any less serious. Only love could have justified the havoc they had lived together, or the many times he had resumed the relationship, even while he knew in his soul that it couldn't work. Love, to Strike, was pain and grief sought, accepted, endured. It was not in Lorelei's bedroom, with the cowgirls on the curtains. And so he had said nothing after her whispered declaration, and then, when she'd asked whether he'd heard her, he'd said, "Yeah, I did." Strike reached for his cigarettes. "Yeah, I did." Well, that had been honest as far as it went. There was nothing wrong with his hearing. After that, there'd been a fairly lengthy silence. Then Lorelei had got out of bed and gone to the bathroom, and stayed there for 30 minutes. Strike assumed that she'd gone there to cry, though she'd been kind enough to do it quietly so that he couldn't hear her. He had lain in bed, wondering what he could say to her that was both kind and truthful, but he knew that nothing short of "I love you too" would be acceptable, and the fact was that he didn't love her, and he wasn't going to lie. When she came back to bed, he had reached out for her in the bed. She'd let him stroke her shoulder for a while, then told him she was tired and needed some sleep. "What was I supposed to fucking do?" he demanded of an imaginary female inquisitor who strongly resembled his sister Lucy. "You could try not accepting tea and blowjobs," came the snide response, to which Strike, with his stump throbbing, answered, "Fuck you." His mobile rang. He had sellotaped up the shattered screen, and through this distorted carapace he saw an unknown number.
"Strike?"
"Hi, Strike. Culpepper here." Dominic Culpepper, who had worked for the News of the World until its closure, had previously put work Strike's way. Relations between them, never personally warm, had become slightly antagonistic when Strike had refused Culpepper the inside story on his two most recent murder cases. Now working for The Sun, Culpepper had been one of those journalists who had most enthusiastically raked over Strike's personal life in the aftermath of the Shacklewell Ripper arrest.
"Wonder if you were free to do a job for us," said Culpepper.
"You've got a fucking nerve."
"What kind of thing you after? Digging up dirt on a government minister?"
"Which one?"
"You'll know if you take the job."
"I'm pretty stretched just now."
"What kind of dirt are we talking?"
"That's what we need you to find out."
How do you know there's dirt there?
A well-placed source, said Culpepper.
Why do you need me if there's a well-placed source?
He's not ready to talk. He just hinted that there are beans to be spilled, lots of them.
Sorry, can't do it, Culpepper, said Strike. I'm booked solid.
Sure? We're paying good money, Strike.
I'm not doing too badly these days, said the detective, lighting a second cigarette from the tip of his first.
Now I'll bet you aren't, you jammy bastard, said Culpepper. All right, it'll have to be Patterson. Do you know him?
The ex-Met guy. Run across him a couple of times, said Strike.
The call finished with mutually insincere good wishes, leaving Strike with an increased feeling of foreboding. He googled Culpepper's name and found his byline on a story about the level playing field from 2 weeks previously. Of course, it was possible that more than one government minister was currently in danger of being exposed by the Sun for an offence against public taste or morals. But the fact that Culpepper had recently been in close proximity with the Winds strongly suggested Robin had been right in suspecting Geraint of tipping off the Sun, and that it was Chisel whom Patterson would shortly be investigating. Strike wondered whether Culpepper knew that he, Strike, was already working for Chisel, whether his call had been designed to startle information out of the detective, but it seemed unlikely. The newspaper man would have been very stupid to tell Strike whom he was about to hire if he was aware that Strike was already in the minister's pay. Strike knew of Mitch Patterson by reputation. They had twice been hired by different halves of divorcing couples in the last year. Previously a senior officer in the Metropolitan Police who had taken early retirement, Patterson was prematurely silver-haired and had the face of an angry pug. Though personally unpleasant, or so Eric Wardle had told Strike, Patterson was a man who got results.
Of course, he won't be able to kick the shit out of people in his new career, Wardle had commented, so that's one useful tool in his arsenal gone.
Strike didn't much relish the thought that Patterson would shortly be on the case. Picking up his mobile again, he noted that neither Robin nor Barclay had called in an update within the last 12 hours. Only the previous day, he had to reassure Chisel, who had called to express his doubts about Robin, given her lack of results thus far. Frustrated by his employees and his own incapacity, Strike texted Robin and Barclay the same message. Son just tried to hire me to investigate Chisel. Call with update ASAP. Need usable info now. Pulling his crutches back towards him, he got up to examine the contents of his fridge and kitchen cupboards, discovering that he would be eating nothing but tinned soup for the next 4 meals, unless he made a trip to the supermarket. After pouring spoiled milk down the sink, he made himself a mug of black tea and returned to the formica table, where he lit a third cigarette and contemplated, without pleasure, the prospect of doing his hamstring stretches. His phone rang again. Seeing that it was Lucy, he let it go to voicemail. The last thing he needed right now was updates on the school board's last meeting. A few minutes after that, when Strike was in the bathroom, she called back. He had hopped back into the kitchen with his trousers at half-mast, in the hope that it was either Robin or Barclay. When he saw his sister's number for a second time, he merely swore loudly and returned to the bathroom. The third call told him that she was not about to give up. Slamming down the can of soup he had been opening, Strike swept up the mobile.
"Lucy, I'm busy. What is it?" he said testily.
"It's Barclay."
"Ah, about time. Any news?"
"A bit on Jimmy's bird, if that helps. Flick."
"It all helps," said Strike. "Why didn't you let me know earlier?"
"Only found out 10 minutes ago," said Barclay, unfazed.
"I've just heard her telling Jimmy in the kitchen. She's been bumping money from her work."
"What work?"
"Didn't they tell me? Trouble is, Jimmy's no that keen on her, from what I've seen. I'm not sure he'd care if she got nicked."
A distracting beeping sounded in Strike's ear. Another caller was trying to get him. Glancing at the phone, he saw that it was Lucy again.
"Tell you something else I got out of him, though,"
said Barclay. Last night when he was stoned, he said he knew a government minister who had blood on his hands. Beep, beep, beep. Strike, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Strike had never told Barclay about Billy's story.
What exactly did he say, Barclay?
He was rambling on about the government, the Tories, what a bunch of bastards they were. Then out of nowhere he says, "I'm fucking killers." I says, "What do you mean?" And he says, "I know one who's got blood on his fucking hands. Kids."
Beep, beep, beep.
Mind you, they're a bunch of bampots, Cor. He might be talking about benefit cuts. That's as good as murder to this lot. Not that I think too much of Chisel's politics myself, Strike.
Seen any sign of Billy, Jimmy's brother?
Nothing. Nobody's mentioned him neither.
Beep, beep, beep.
And no sign of Jimmy nipping off to Oxfordshire. Not on my watch.
Beep, beep, beep.
All right, said Strike. Keep digging. Let me know if you get anything.
He rang off, jabbed at his phone's screen, and brought up Lucy's call instead.
Lucy, hi, he said impatiently. Bit busy now, can I?
But as she began to talk, his expression became blank. Before she had finished gasping out the reason for her call, he had grabbed his door keys and was scrabbling for his crutches.
Chapter 25. We shall try if we cannot make you powerless to do any harm. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Strike's text requesting an update reached Robin at 10 to 9, as she arrived in the corridor where Izzy and Wynne's offices lay. So keen was she to see what he had to say that she stopped dead in the middle of the deserted passage to read it.
"Oh, shit," she murmured,
reading that the sun was becoming ever more interested in Chisel. Leaning up against the wall of the corridor with its curved stone jambs, every oak door shut, she braced herself to call Strike back. They had not spoken since she had refused to tail Jimmy. When she had phoned him on Monday to apologize directly, Lorelei had answered.
"Oh, hi, Robin, it's me."
One of the awful things about Lorelei was that she was likable. For reasons Robin preferred not to explore, she would have much preferred Lorelei to be unpleasant.
"He's in the shower, sorry. He's been here all weekend. He did his knee in following somebody. He won't tell me the details, but I suppose you know. He had to call me from the street. It was dreadful. He couldn't stand up. I got a cabbie to take me there and paid him to help me get Corm upstairs. He can't wear the prosthesis. He's on crutches."
"Just tell him I was checking in," said Robin, her stomach like ice. "Nothing important."
Robin had replayed the conversation several times in her head since. There had been an unmistakably proprietorial note in Lorelei's voice as she talked about Strike. It had been Lorelei whom he had called when he was in trouble.
Well, of course it was. What was he going to do, call you in Oxfordshire?
Lorelei, in whose flat he had spent the rest of the weekend.
They're dating. Where else was he going to go?
Lorelei, who was looking after him, consoling him, and perhaps uniting with him in abuse of Robin, without whom this injury might not have happened. And now she had to call Strike and tell him that, 5 days on, she had no useful information. Wynne's office, which had been so conveniently accessible when she started work 2 weeks ago, was now carefully locked up whenever Geraint and Amir had to leave it. Robin was sure that this was Amir's doing, that he had become suspicious of her after the incidents of the dropped bangle and of Raphael calling loud attention to her eavesdropping on Amir's phone call.
"Post!"
Robin whirled around to see the cart trundling towards her, pushed by a genial grey-haired man.
"I'll take anything for Chisel and Wynne. We're having a meeting," Robin heard herself say.
The postman handed over a stack of letters, along with a box with a clear cellophane window, through which Robin saw a life-size and very realistic plastic fetus. The legend across the top read, "It is legal to murder me."
"Oh, God, that's horrible," said Robin.
The postman chortled.
"That's nothing compared to some of what they get," he said comfortably.
"Remember the white powder that was on the news? Anthrax, they claimed. Proper hoo-ha, that was. Oh, and I delivered a turd in a box once. Couldn't smell it through all the wrapping. The baby's for Wynne, not Chisel. She's the pro-choice one. Enjoying it here, are you? He said, showing a disposition for chat. Loving it, Robin said, whose attention had been caught by one of the envelopes she had so rashly taken. Excuse me. Turning her back on Izzy's office, she hurried past the postman, and 5 minutes later emerged onto the terrace cafe, which sat on the bank of the Thames. It was separated from the river by a low stone wall, which was punctuated with black iron lamps. To the left and right stood Westminster and Lambeth Bridges, respectively. The former painted the green of the seats in the House of Commons, the latter scarlet like those in the House of Lords. On the opposite bank rose the white façade of County Hall, while between palace and hall rolled the broad Thames, its oily surface lucent grey over muddy depths. Sitting down out of earshot of the few early morning coffee drinkers, Robin turned her attention to one of the letters addressed to Geraint Wynne that she had so recklessly taken from the postman. The sender's name and address had been carefully inscribed on the reverse of the envelope in a shaky cursive. Sir Kevin Rogers, 16 The Elms, Fleetwood, Kent. And she happened to know, due to her extensive background reading on the Wynne's charity, that the elderly Sir Kevin, who had won a silver at the hurdles in the 1956 Olympics, was one of the level playing field's trustees. What things, Robin asked herself, did people feel the need to put in writing these days, when phone calls and emails were so much easier and faster? Using her mobile, she found a number for Sir Kevin and Lady Rogers at the correct address. They were old enough, she thought, to still use a landline. Taking a fortifying gulp of coffee, she texted Strike back. Following a lead, we'll call ASAP. She then turned off caller ID on her mobile, took out a pen and the notebook in which she had written Sir Kevin's number, and punched in the digits. An elderly woman answered with three rings. Robin affected what she was afraid was a poor Welsh accent.
"Could I speak to Sir Kevin, please?"
"Is that Della? Is Sir Kevin there?"
asked Robin again, a little louder. She had been hoping to avoid actually claiming to be a government minister.
"Kevin?"
called the woman.
"Kevin, it's Della."
There was a noise of shuffling that made Robin think of tartan bedroom slippers.
"Hello?"
"Kevin, Grinds just got your letter," said Robin,
wincing as her accent wobbled somewhere between Cardiff and Lahore.
"Sorry, Della, what?"
said the man feebly. He seemed to be deaf, which was both help and hindrance. Robin spoke more loudly, enunciating as clearly as she could. Sir Kevin grasped what she was saying on her third attempt.
"I told Geraint I'd have to resign unless he took urgent steps," he said miserably. "You're an old friend, Della, and it is a worthy cause. But I have to think of my own position. I did warn him." "But why Kevin?"
said Robin, picking up her pen.
"Hasn't he shown you my letter?"
"No," said Robin truthfully, pen poised.
"Oh, dear,"
said Sir Kevin weakly.
"Well, for one thing, £25,000 unaccounted for is a serious matter."
"What else?" asked Robin, making rapid notes.
"What's that?"
"You said, for one thing. What else are you worried about?"
Robin could hear the woman who'd answered the phone talking in the background. Her voice sounded irate.
"Della, I'd rather not go into it all on the phone,"
said Sir Kevin, sounding embarrassed.
"Well, this is disappointing," said Robin,
with what she hoped was a touch of Della's mellifluous grandeur.
"I hoped you'd at least tell me why, Kevin."
"Well, there's the Mo Farah business."
"Mo Farah?" repeated Robin, in unaffected surprise.
"What was that? Mo Farah?" "You didn't know,"
said Sir Kevin.
"Oh dear, oh dear."
Robin heard footsteps, and then the woman came back on the line, first muffled, then clear.
"Let me speak to her. Kevin, let go. Look, Della, Kevin's very upset about all this. He suspected you didn't know what's been going on, and, well, here we are. He was right.
"Nobody ever wants to worry you, Della," she said, sounding as though she thought this a mistaken protectiveness. "But the fact of the matter is..." "No, she's got to know, Kevin. Geraint's been promising people things he can't deliver. Disabled children and their families have been told they're getting visits from David Beckham and Mo Farah, and I don't know who else. It's all going to come out, Della, now the Charity Commission's involved, and I'm not having Kevin's name dragged through the mud. He's a conscientious man, and he's done his best. He's been urging Geraint to sort out the accounts for months now, and then there's what Elspeth..." "No, Kevin, I'm not. I'm just telling her." "Well, it could get very nasty, Della. It might yet come to the police as well as the press, and I'm sorry, but I'm thinking of Kevin's health." "What's Elspeth's story?" said Robin, still writing fast. Sir Kevin said something plaintive in the background. "I'm not going into that on the phone," said Lady Rogers repressively. "You'll have to ask Elspeth." There was more shuffling, and Sir Kevin took the receiver again. He sounded almost tearful. "Della, you know how much I admire you. I wish it could have been otherwise."
"Yes," said Robin.
"Well, I'll have to call Elspeth then." "What was that?" "I'll call Elspeth." "Oh, dear," said Sir Kevin. "But, you know, there might be nothing in it."
Robin wondered whether she dared ask for Elspeth's number, but decided not. Della would surely have it.
"I wish you'd tell me what Elspeth's story is," she said, her pen poised over her notebook. "I don't like to," said Sir Kevin wheezily. "The damage these kinds of rumours do to a man's reputation."
Lady Rogers came back on the line.
"That's all we've got to say. This whole business has been very hard on Kevin, very stressful. I'm sorry. But that's our final word on the matter, Della. Goodbye."
Robin set her mobile down on the table beside her and checked that nobody was looking her way. She picked up her mobile again and scrolled down the list of the Level Playing Fields trustees. One of them was called Dr. Elspeth Curtis Lacey, but her personal number was not listed on the charity's website and appeared, from a search of directory inquiries, to be unlisted. Robin phoned Strike. The call went straight to voicemail. She waited a couple of minutes and tried again, with the same result. After her third failed attempt to reach him, she texted, "Got some stuff on GW. Call me." The dank shadow that had lain on the terrace when she had first arrived was moving incrementally backwards. The warm sun slid over Robin's table as she eked out her coffee, waiting for Strike to call back. At last her phone vibrated to show that she had a text. Heart leaping, she picked it up, but it was only Matthew. "Fancy a drink with Tom and Sarah tonight after work." Robin contemplated the message with a mixture of lassitude and dread. Tomorrow was the charity cricket match about which Matthew was so excited. After-work drinks with Tom and Sarah would doubtless mean plenty of banter on the subject. She could already picture the four of them at the bar. Sarah with her perennially flirtatious attitude towards Matthew, Tom fending off Matthew's jokes about his lousy bowling with increasingly clumsy, angry riposts, and Robin, as was increasingly the case these days, pretending to be amused and interested, because that was the cost of not being harangued by Matthew for seeming bored or feeling superior to her company, or, as happened during their worst rows, wishing that she were drinking with Strike instead. At least, she consoled herself, it couldn't be a late or drunken night, because Matthew, who took all sporting fixtures seriously, would want a decent sleep before the match. So she texted back, "Okay, where?" and continued to wait for Strike to ring her. After 40 minutes, Robin began to wonder whether Strike was somewhere he couldn't call, which left open the question of whether she ought to inform Chisel of what she had just found out. Would Strike consider that a liberty, or would he be more annoyed if she failed to give Chisel his bargaining chip, given the time pressure? After debating the matter inwardly for a while longer, she called Izzy, the upper half of whose office window she could see from where she sat.
"Izzy, it's me, Venetia. I'm calling because I can't say this in front of Raphael. I think I've got some information on Wynne for your father."
"Oh, fabulous," said Izzy loudly.
And Robin heard Raphael in the background saying,
"Is that Venetia? Where is she?"
And the clicking of computer keys.
"Checking the diary, Venetia.
He'll be at DCMS until 11, but then he's in meetings all afternoon. Do you want me to call him? He could probably see you straight away if you hurry.
So Robin replaced her mobile, notebook and pen in her bag, gulped down the last of her coffee, and hurried off to the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. Chisel was pacing up and down his office, speaking on the phone when Robin arrived outside the glass partition. He beckoned her inside, pointed to a low leather sofa at a short distance from his desk, and continued to talk to somebody who appeared to have displeased him.
"It was a gift," he was saying distinctly into the receiver, "from my eldest son, 24-carat gold, inscribed Nec Aspera Terrant. Bloody hell's bells!" he roared suddenly.
And Robin saw the heads of the bright young people just outside the office turning towards Chisel.
"It's Latin. Pass me to somebody who can speak English. Jasper Chisel. I'm the Minister for Culture. I've given you the date. No, you can't. I haven't got all bloody day."
Robin gathered from the side of the conversation that she could hear that Chisel had lost a money clip of sentimental value, which he thought he might have left at a hotel where he and Kinvara had spent the night of her birthday. As far as she could hear, the hotel staff had not only failed to find the clip, they were showing insufficient deference to Chisel for having deigned to stay at one of their hotels.
"I want somebody to call me back."
"Bloody useless," muttered Chisel, hanging up and peering at Robin as though he had forgotten who she was. Still breathing heavily, he dropped down on the sofa opposite her.
"I've got 10 minutes, so this had better be worthwhile."
"I've got some information on Mr. Wynne," said Robin, taking out her notebook. Without waiting for his response, she gave him a succinct summary of the information she had gleaned from Sir Kevin.
"And," she concluded, barely a minute and a half later, "there may be further impropriety on Mr. Wynne's part, but that information is allegedly held by Dr. Elspeth Curtis Lacey, whose number is unlisted. It shouldn't take us long to find a way of contacting her, but I thought..."
Robin said apprehensively, because Chisel's tiny eyes were screwed up in what might have been displeasure. "I should bring you this immediately."
For a few seconds he simply stared at her, his expression petulant as ever. But then he slapped his thigh in what was clearly pleasure.
"Well, well, well," he said. "He told me you were his best. Yes, said so."
Pulling a crumpled handkerchief out of his pocket, he wiped his face, which had become sweaty during his phone call with the unfortunate hotel.
"Well, well, well," he said again. "This is turning out to be a rather good day. One by one they trip themselves up. So Wynne's a thief and a liar, and maybe more."
"Well," said Robin cautiously, "he can't account for the £25,000, and he certainly promised things he can't deliver."
"Dr. Elspeth Curtis Lacey," said Chisel, following his own train of thought. "Name's familiar."
"She used to be a Liberal Democrat councillor from Northumberland," said Robin, who had just read this on the Level Playing Fields website.
"Child abuse," said Chisel suddenly. "That's how I know her, child abuse. She was on some committee. She's a bloody crank about it, sees it everywhere. Course it's full of cranks, the Lib Dems. It's where they congregate, stuffed to the gunnels with oddballs."
He stood up, levering a smattering of dandruff behind him on the black leather, and paced up and down, frowning.
"All this charity stuff's bound to come out sooner or later," he said, echoing Sir Kevin's wife. "But my Christ, they wouldn't want it to break right now, not with Della up to her neck in the Paralympics. Wynne's going to panic when he finds out, I know, yes. I think this might well neutralize him, in the short term, anyway. If he's been fiddling with children, though..."
"There's no proof of that," said Robin.
"That would stymie him for good," said Chisel, pacing again. "Well, well, well. This explains why Wynne wanted to bring his trustees to our Paralympian reception next Thursday, doesn't it? He's clearly trying to keep them sweet, stop anyone else deserting the sinking ship. Prince Harry's going to be there. These charity people love a royal. Only reason half of them are in it."
He scratched his thick mop of grey hair, revealing large patches of underarm sweat.
"Here's what we'll do," he said. "We'll add his trustees to the guest list and you can come too. Then you can corner this Curtis Lacey, find out what she's got, all right? Night of the 12th.
"Yes,"
said Robin, making a note.
Fine.
In the meantime, I'll let Wynne know I know he's had his fingers in the till.
Robin was almost at the door when Chisel said abruptly,
You don't want a PA's job, I suppose?
Sorry?
Take over from Izzy. What does that detective pay you? I could probably match it. I need somebody with brains and a bit of backbone.
I'm happy where I am, said Robin.
Chisel grunted.
Well, perhaps it's better this way. I might well have a bit more work for you, once we've got rid of Wynne and Knight. Off you go, then.
He turned his back on her, his hand already on the phone. Out in the sunshine, Robin took out her mobile again. Strike still hadn't called, but Matthew had texted the name of a pub in Mayfair, conveniently close to Sarah's work. Nevertheless, Robin was now able to contemplate the evening with slightly more cheerfulness than she had felt prior to her meeting with Chisel. She even started humming Bob Marley as she walked back towards the Houses of Parliament.
"He told me you were his best, yours," said so.
Chapter 26 I am not so entirely alone even now. There are two of us to bear the solitude together here. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. It was 4 in the morning, the hopeless hour when shivering insomnia inhabits a world of hollow shadow, and existence seems frail and strange. Strike, who had fallen into a doze, woke abruptly in the hospital chair. For a second, all he felt was his aching body and the hunger that tore at his stomach. Then he saw his 9-year-old nephew, Jack, who lay motionless in the bed beside him, jelly pads over his eyes, a tube running down his throat, lines coming out of neck and wrist. A bag of urine hung from the side of the bed, while 3 separate drips fed their contents into a body that appeared tiny and vulnerable amid the softly humming machines in the hushed, cavernous space of the intensive care ward. He could hear the padding of a nurse's soft shoes somewhere beyond the curtain surrounding Jack's bed. They hadn't wanted Strike to spend the night in the chair, but he had dug in, and his celebrity, minor though it was, combined with his disability, had worked in his favour. His crutches stood propped against the bedside cabinet. The ward was overwarm, as hospitals always were. Strike had spent many weeks in a series of iron beds after his leg had been blown off. The smell transported him back to a time of pain and brutal readjustment, when he had been forced to recalibrate his life against a backdrop of endless obstacles, indignities, and privations. The curtain rustled and a nurse entered the cubicle, stolid and practical in her overalls. Seeing that he was awake, she gave Strike a brief, professional smile, then took the clipboard off the end of Jack's bed, and went to take readings from the screens monitoring his blood pressure and oxygen levels. When she had finished, she whispered,
"Fancy a cup of tea?"
"Is he doing all right?" Strike asked, not bothering to disguise the plea in his voice. "How's everything looking?"
"He's stable, no need to worry. This is what we expect at this stage. Tea?"
"Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks very much."
He realized that his bladder was full once the curtain had closed behind the nurse. Wishing he'd thought to ask her to pass his crutches, Strike hoisted himself up, holding the arm of the chair to steady himself, hopped to the wall and grabbed them, then swung out from behind the curtain and off towards the brightly lit rectangle at the far end of the dark ward. Having relieved himself at a urinal beneath a blue light that was supposed to thwart Junkie's ability to locate veins, he headed into the waiting room, close to the ward, where, late yesterday afternoon, he had sat waiting for Jack to come out of emergency surgery. The father of one of Jack's school friends, with whom Jack was meant to be staying the night when his appendix burst, had kept him company. The man had been determined not to leave Strike alone until they had seen the little chap out of the woods, and had talked nervously all the time Jack had been in surgery, saying things like, "They bounce at that age, he's a tough little bugger. Lucky we only live 5 minutes from school," and over again, "Greg and Lucy will be going frantic." Strike had said nothing, barely listening, holding himself ready for the worst news,
texting Lucy every 30 minutes with an update. Not yet out of surgery. No news yet. At last the surgeon had come to tell them that Jack, who had had to be resuscitated on arrival at hospital, had made it through surgery, that he had had a nasty case of sepsis, and that he would shortly be arriving in intensive care. "I'll bring his mates in to see him," said Lucy and Greg's pal excitedly. "Cheer him up. Pokemon cards."
"He won't be ready for that," said the surgeon repressively. "He'll be under heavy sedation and on a ventilator for at least the next 24 hours.
Are you the next of kin?"
"No, that's me," croaked Strike, speaking at last, his mouth dry. "I'm his uncle. His parents are in Rome for their wedding anniversary. They're trying to get a flight back right now."
"Ah, I see. Well, he's not quite out of the woods yet, but the surgery was successful. We've cleaned out his abdomen and put a drain in. They'll be bringing him down shortly."
"Told you," said Lucy and Greg's friend, beaming at Strike with tears in his eyes.
"Told you they'd bounce."
"Yeah," said Strike. "I'd better let Lucy know."
But in a calamity of errors, Jack's panic-stricken parents had arrived at the airport, only to realize that Lucy had somehow lost her passport between hotel room and departure gate. In fruitless desperation, they retraced their steps, trying to explain their dilemma to everyone from hotel staff, police, and the British Embassy, with the upshot that they had missed the last flight of the night. At 4:10 in the morning, the waiting room was mercifully deserted. Strike turned on the mobile he had kept switched off while on the ward, and saw a dozen missed calls from Robin and one from Lorelei. Ignoring them, he texted Lucy, who, he knew, would be awake in the Rome hotel to which, shortly past midnight, her passport had been delivered by the taxi driver who had found it. Lucy had implored Strike to send a picture of Jack when he got out of surgery. Strike had pretended that the picture wouldn't load. After the stress of the day, Lucy didn't need to see her son ventilated, his eyes covered in pads, his body swamped by the baggy hospital gown. "All looking good," he typed. "Still sedated, but nurse confident." He pressed send and waited. As he had expected, she responded within 2 minutes. "You must be exhausted. Have they given you a bed at the hospital?" "No, I'm sitting next to him," Strike responded. "I'll stay here until you get back. Try and get some sleep and don't worry. Kiss." Strike switched off his mobile, dragged himself back onto his one foot, reorganized his crutches, and returned to the ward. The tea was waiting for him, as pale and milky as anything Denise had made. But after emptying 2 sachets of sugar into it, he drank it in a couple of gulps, eyes moving between Jack and the machines both supporting and monitoring him. He had never before examined the boy so closely. Indeed, he had never had much to do with him, in spite of the pictures he drew for Strike, which Lucy passed on. "He hero worships you," Lucy had told Strike several times. "He wants to be a soldier." But Strike avoided family get-togethers, partly because he disliked Jack's father, Greg, and partly because Lucy's desire to cajole her brother into some more conventional mode of existence was enervating, even without the presence of her sons, the eldest of whom Strike found especially like his father. Strike had no desire to have children, and while he was prepared to concede that some of them were likable, was prepared to admit, in fact, that he had conceived a certain detached fondness for Jack on the back of Lucy's tales of his ambition to join the Redcaps, he had steadfastly resisted birthday parties and Christmas get-togethers at which he might have forged a closer connection. But now, as dawn crept through the thin curtains blocking Jack's bed from the rest of the ward, Strike saw for the first time the boy's resemblance to his grandmother, Strike's own mother, Leda. He had the same very dark hair, pale skin, and finely drawn mouth. He would, in fact, have made a beautiful girl, but Leda's son knew what puberty was about to do to the boy's jaw and neck. If he lived.
"Course he's going to bloody live," the nurse said. "He's in intensive fucking care. They don't put you in here for hiccups. He's tough, wants to join the military. He'll be okay. He'd fucking better be. I never even sent him a text to say thank you for his pictures."
It took Strike a while to drop back into an uneasy doze. He was woken by early morning sunshine penetrating his eyelids. Squinting against the light, he heard footsteps squeaking on the floor. Next came a loud rattle as the curtain was pulled back, opening Jack's bed to the ward again, and revealing more motionless figures, lying in beds all around them. A new nurse stood beaming at him, younger, with a long dark ponytail.
"Hi," she said brightly, taking Jack's clipboard. "It's not often we get anyone famous in here. I know all about you. I read everything about how you caught that serial—"
"This is my nephew, Jack," he said coldly. The idea of discussing the Shacklewell Ripper now was repugnant to him. The nurse's smile faltered.
"Would you mind waiting outside the curtain? We need to take blood, change his drips in his catheter."
Strike dragged himself back onto his crutches and made his way laboriously out of the ward again, trying not to focus on any of the other inert figures wired to their own buzzing machines. The canteen was already half full when he got there. Unshaven and heavy-eyed, he had slid his tray all the way to the till and paid before he realized he could not carry it and manage his crutches. A young girl clearing tables spotted his predicament and came to help.
"Cheers," said Strike gruffly, when she had placed the tray on a table beside a window.
"No probs," said the girl. "Leave it there after. I'll get it."
The small kindness made Strike feel disproportionately emotional. Ignoring the fry-up he had just bought, he took out his phone and texted Lucy again. "All fine. Nurse changing his drip. We'll be back with him shortly. Kiss." As he had half expected, his phone rang as soon as he had cut into his fried egg.
"We've got a flight," Lucy told him without preamble. "But it's not until 11.
"No problem," he told her. "I'm not going anywhere."
"Is he awake yet?"
"No, still sedated."
"He'll be so chuffed to see you if he wakes before...
She burst into tears. Strike could hear her still trying to talk through her sobs.
"Just want to get home. Want to see him."
For the first time in Strike's life, he was glad to hear Greg, who now took the phone from his wife. "We're bloody grateful, Corm. This is our first weekend away together in 5 years. Can you believe it?"
"Sod law."
"Yeah. He said his belly was sore, but I thought he was at it. Thought he didn't want us to go away. I feel a right bastard now, I can tell you."
"Don't worry," said Strike, and again, "I'm going nowhere."
After a few more exchanges and a tearful farewell from Lucy, Strike was left to his full English. He ate methodically and without pleasure amid the clatter and jangle of the canteen, surrounded by other miserable and anxious people tucking into fatty, sugar-laden food. As he was finishing the last of his bacon, a text from Robin arrived. "I've been trying to call with an update on Wynne. Let me know when it's convenient to talk." The chisel case seemed a remote thing to Strike just now, but as he read her text, he suddenly had a simultaneous craving for nicotine and to hear Robin's voice. Abandoning his tray, with thanks to the kind girl who had helped him to his table, he set off again on his crutches. A cluster of smokers stood around the entrance to the hospital, hunched-shouldered like hyenas in the clean morning air. Strike lit up, inhaled deeply, and called Robin back.
"Hi," he said when she answered. "Sorry I haven't been in touch. I've been at the hospital."
"What's happened? Are you okay?"
"Yeah, I'm fine. It's my nephew, Jack. His appendix burst yesterday, and he's got—"
To Strike's mortification, his voice cracked. As he fought to conquer himself, he wondered how long it had been since he had cried. Perhaps not since the tears of pain and rage he had shed in the hospital in Germany, to which he had been airlifted away from the patch of bloody ground where the IED had ripped off his leg.
"Fuck," he muttered at last, the only syllable he seemed able to manage.
"Cormoran? What's happened?"
"He's... they've got him in intensive care," said Strike.
His face crumbled up in the effort to hold himself together, to speak normally.
"His mum, Lucy and Greg, are stuck in Rome, so they asked me."
"Who's with you? Is Lorelei there?"
"C- Christ, no.
Lorelei saying, I love you, seemed weak